Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here. Thanks so much for listening. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Mark Dubowitz, CEO of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. If you want to know about the weaponry, you want to know about the strategy, if you want to see the maps, a lot of times you see the maps that you see on Fox News Channel are generated from the Defense of Democracies. That's how intricate they are and how tapped in they are. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, the pulse of the Republican Party. As you know, they're trying to do two things. Maybe get a second supplemental bill when it comes to maybe fueling the economy, number two. Number two would be passing the Save America Act, which is basically voter ID. They're trying to do both those things. What are the chances of doing that before the elections in November? And we have this thing called war with Iran happening. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This was a vile protest rooted in white supremacy entitled Stop the Islamic Takeover of New York City. I'm the first Muslim mayor of our city. Anti-Muslim bigotry is nothing new to me.
Talk about burying the lead, Mayor Mamdani. Made it about you. The anti-Semitic Muslims. He has the anti-Semitic Muslim over for dinner while Islamic extremist attacks us here in New York City. And he is worried about what he says are anti-Muslim protests in front. He misses the story of the two bombers who were screaming anti-American phrases and pro-ISIS.
Number two.
President Trump wants the Department of Homeland Security. He wants TSA. He wants FEMA. He wants the brave men and women of our United States Coast Guard to receive their paychecks. And he wants this department to be fully funded and fully reopened.
Dems continue to keep DHS unfunded and TSA workers without paychecks to support some bizarre, irrational stand against ICE. Why this has to end this week.
Number one.
Are they more formidable than you anticipated, General?
I think they're fighting, and I respect that, but I don't think they're more formidable than what we thought.
Day 12 of Epic Fury. We talk energy, getting the Hormuz Strait out, Strait opened, and retaliation still exists as the courage of a defecting soccer team in Australia from Iran should inspire all Iranians. And this is what I'm talking about. I'll just handle the soccer team first. So they play a game. And when they go to play the international game against the Australian team in a tournament, they don't sing the national anthem. That got broadcast back into Iran, and some of the broadcasters there said all these Iranian women who did not sing the national anthem should be put in jail when they get home. At which time, the women begin to panic, get upset. They sang the next time, but at least five of them said, I'm not going back. Even though they have families back there for the most part, then there's another coach that decided to defect. So there's all this drama. But the whole thing wasn't going to happen until President Trump said, hey, Australia, offer them asylum. And if not, we will take them. And then the Australian government sprung into action. The president has praised them since, and I'm very happy about that. I hope you are, too. It'll be a great time for Megan Rapinoe, Jemele Hill, some of the people who speak out so early and often and for trans rights to be able to play against women in sports, all that stuff. What about, instead of speaking out against our country, what about speaking out for the people who have no rights in Iran, who might want some freedom here in the West or in Australia down under? be a great time to hear from Megan Rapinoe and some of those outspoken critics of the American dream. Meanwhile, let's talk about the war itself. Here's General Jack Keane on where we're at. Cut four.
The offensive operation is succeeding daily to strip away all of their offensive capability, ballistic missiles and drones. And we're penetrating underneath the ground to underground sites to get those missiles, take down those launchers, take down the transportation that moves them, take down the command and control. It is a systematic, deliberate approach to do it. And the same thing with the drones. And the proof is there. Objectively, the percentage of their ability to retaliate is down way over 90%. That is quite remarkable in itself.
And they are aiming in retaliatory strikes. They did combine against Israel for the first time with Hezbollah. And I think Hezbollah is really being run by the Iranians at this point. The IRGC went in there right before the war started. I think they're doing command and control, and they're sending cluster ballistic missiles, explosive devices at its head into Israel. But so far, everyone's okay. But the retaliation has been there, but it's just not been as plentiful and somewhat surprising. They're aiming at Kuwait's energy sector, and where they think Americans would like to stay in hotels or office buildings. They're targeting the desalinization plants in Bahrain. And in Iraq, they're hitting some sites where they think Americans would like to frequent. And those are the militias that are located in their country. So that's when General Dan Kane said, you know, some of the parts that they're coming back and attacking us at are somewhat surprising. Here's more, General Cut Three.
Are they more formidable than you anticipated, General?
I think they're fighting, and I respect that, but I don't think they're more formidable than what we thought.
Yeah, he goes on, cut two.
CENTCOM continues to make progress across the southern flank. To date, they've struck more than 5,000 targets. Ballistic missile attacks continue to trend downward, 90% from where they've started. And one-way attack drones have decreased 83% since the beginning of the operation.
So what they're trying to do is hurt us economically, and they're doing that with the Strait of Hormuz. But, they don't have... this ultimately is going to add bad for them. That Karg Island, which is their oil island, where 90% of their oil travels through and transports, we could take that in a second just by showing a presence there. All shipments would stop. So the United Kingdom Maritime Trade Corporation, which is run by the British military, said their vessel was hit just north of Oman in the Strait. A cargo ship that was struck Wednesday by a projectile on the Strait of Hormuz, setting it on fire. That's another ship that was hit. So when that happens, it gets really hard to insure these ships, which makes the price of oil go up. But just keep in mind, only 3% of American oil comes through there. The people that are going to be hurt are the Far East and China. China especially. So they're the ones who are getting their discount pirated oil out. But right now, no one's getting anything out. I think there was one tanker that got through yesterday. So, yeah, are the Iranians fighting back? Yeah, where are they going to go? Of course, they're going to fight back. They're either going to run or fight back. But I thought it was so interesting that Benjamin Netanyahu went and addressed on video the Iranian people yesterday. He said to the Iranian people, the coming days will bring you an opportunity to free yourselves. Be ready, as an elite counterterrorism unit has been deployed to protect Iran's newly appointed supreme leader. So they're worried about their leader's safety. Netanyahu says the Iranian people, get ready to take back your country. Now, this is why it's not just rhetoric. If anybody outside the Iranians themselves understands what's happening on the ground, more than any other Arab state, it is Israel. They knew Iran was the threat to the sanctuary and security. They always knew it. So they've infiltrated deep into Iran. And there's so many people there that are informants for the Israelis because they just hate their government. So if they're saying that, he just doesn't say that in a wanton fashion. There's a reason. And by the way, the good news is the Ayatollah's son, the new supreme leader, has been hit and wounded. It was on Iranian television. They said their wounded veteran now in charge. That's pretty much what they're admitting. The word is his legs. He might have an amputation, but they do have a extreme security around him because more than likely the Israelis are about to take him out. That's what I think. Anyway, here's Victoria Coates, cut six.
I think it is because we're starting to lose their major capabilities. These aren't ballistic missiles anymore. Their mine layers are their smaller ships. We've sunk 50 of their Navy. They didn't have a huge Navy to begin with. For us to lose 50 ships would be catastrophic. For Iran, it means they no longer have that capability. So these are much smaller ships that lay the mines. And remember, this happened before. It happened in 1989 under President Reagan, and he initiated Project Praying Mantis to demine the strait. This can be done. We have this capability. So I think we are seeing the Iranians lose their capacity for ballistic missiles, lose their capacity for attack drones. This is kind of their last gasp.
And I'm not going to play it now. I'm going to save it for my next guest. But so they're taking apart their ballistic missile program. They'll continue to blow up and degrade their nuclear program. They're killing over between 40 and 80 of their leaders. And you got Jake Sullivan, part of the worst international security team that we've ever had in the White House, says we're not safer than we were. Are you insane? Leaving this evil regime armed to the teeth with enough nuclear material to make 11 bombs and bragging about it? 460 kilograms? And he says we're not safer. I'm going to play that for Mark Dubowitz and Rich Lowry. He's coming up at the bottom of the hour. Where politics plays into this, President of the United States is going to be going out talking about the economy in Kentucky and Ohio. Busy day. Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Iran is not acting like they're a defeated power. Hitting a U.S. Asset in Iraq, hitting Tel Aviv, or trying to hit Tel Aviv, no reported casualties at least so far, hitting civilian targets in the Gulf states, hitting ships in the Strait of Hormuz, including setting a Thai ship on fire, and some of the crew are missing. Even though there are reports that the new Ayatollah, the new supreme leader, is perhaps injured, even though America and Israel continues to pummel Iran, Iran is not behaving like it's a defeated power, to say the least.
That is Mark Halperin. Now let's bring in the CEO, Mark Dubowitz, of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Mark, do you agree with Mark Halperin?
Well, Brian, I think they're not yet defeated, but they are being defeated. You heard Admiral Bradley Cooper's details, briefing. You know, their ballistic missile production capability, their defense industrial base is getting decimated. Brian, I've been working on this for 20 years. If you told me a few months ago that Iran would be left without a missile base, without a production capability, I would have thought you were crazy. But this is what's going on. And so I think the U.S. military is systematically decimating their ability to make war. But of course, in the days that come, we're going to see the Iranians retaliate.
What else would they do? Here's Jake Sullivan, cut nine.
It's a cost, I think, in terms of strain in our relationships across the Gulf as they deal with the incoming from Iran. It's a cost in terms of our capacity to shape events globally because we're mired down in the Middle East right now. And also, we've chose to just launch a war of choice with no imminent threat. And I think that degrades America's overall capacity for global leadership.
Jake Sullivan, I can't tolerate it anymore. But what he did for 4 years to make America weaker, while not too arrogant to understand how susceptible he made us, he's critical of this administration for doing a war of choice against Iran, who he was trying to cut a deal with.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right, Brian. I mean, you know who our Gulf allies were furious with? They were furious with the Biden administration because the Biden administration was weak against our enemies and at the end of the day left the Gulf allies vulnerable. You know who the Gulf allies are furious with today? They're furious with Iran. And so we've got our Gulf allies on board. This was not a war of choice. And in fact, if anything, under the Biden administration, Iran saw a massive expansion in their nuclear program to enrichment levels near weapons grade because they perceived the Biden administration was weak. So I know Jake. I like Jake. Very rich coming from Jake after 4 years of feckless leadership from the Biden administration against our enemies.
So here's the thing. One of the most damaging things he did is get the Houthis off the terror list and say that Saudi Arabia was a pariah nation. He flipped everything on its head, and he got the thumb in his eye for the next 4 years. And he also said famously that the Middle East has never been quieter the day before the January 7th attacks. Never been more peaceful place. So where is his instinct?
Right. I mean, right before Hamas invades Israel on October 7th, he writes a piece in Foreign Affairs saying Middle East has never been quieter. So, you know, again, I like Jake. I respect his service. But I think the fact of the matter is our allies and our enemies have seen the change since President Trump came into office. And right now, the regime in Iran is getting absolutely pounded from the air, from our Navy ships, and through our close partnership with Israel. I think the other thing that the Biden administration did is they put a lot of distance between us and Israel. And we have now learned that there is no partner that we have in the world like Israel. There's no, quote, model ally, as the Trump at Pentagon called them, which is able to fight and die in its own defense, but also operate at a peer level with the greatest military in the world, which is the U.S. military.
Right. So we hear Netanyahu says, guys, get ready in Iran. You get ready to take back your country. We're plowing the ground and seeing for it to do that. What does that tell you? What is Netanyahu about to do? Well, what has he done? Because we have very few eyes on the ground there that are coming public.
Yeah, Brian, I think one of the biggest confusions out there is that there's no plan. We are right now executing a military plan. And after major U.S. and Israeli combat operations are over, there is a next phase plan of maximum pressure on the regime, maximum support for the Iranian people, and continued maximum fracturing of the elite support base. And the Israelis, as we've seen, demonstrated over a number of years, have remarkable capabilities on the ground in Iran. Significant penetration, intelligence penetration, and dominance when it comes to the Iranian regime and its security apparatus. And right now, one of their missions, as we take out the missile capabilities and naval capabilities of the Iranian regime, the Israelis they're implementing a decapitation campaign. They're going after the repression apparatus of this regime and hitting the Basij and the Ministry of Intelligence and the IRGC and those responsible for brutalizing Iranians very hard, and therefore opening up space for Iranians to come to the streets, take back their country, and not face the kind of devastation that they did in January.
Mark Dubowitz with us now. He's Zooming if you're watching online. But if you're listening in the car, Mark is the CEO of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Mark, I don't know what's going on the ground. Are you telling me that the Israelis on some level are operating on the ground there? Because it's hard to take out guys on motorcycles from the air. And that's what the besieged do for the most part. They dress in plain clothes. They buzz around the neighborhood and beat people up or kill them and jail them.
Yeah, look, the Israelis have been operating on the ground in Iran for quite some time. They're also from the air, have killed thousands of IRGC and Basij personnel, and they are obviously providing support to Iranians. But ultimately, it's going to have to be Iranians who take to the streets and who take on the Basij and take on the law enforcement personnel, and they have to be supported. I mean, they have to be armed, Brian. I've been saying for many years, you've got to arm the Iranian opposition. You know, you can't have peaceful civil disobedience. This is not Mahatma Gandhi and the British in India or Martin Luther King in America. This is a brutal Islamic Republic with brutal security forces that killed 32,000 Iranians in January. We got to arm them. We got to provide them with communication devices so they can communicate and mobilize. We got to provide them with money for strike funds so they can bring the Iranian energy industry to its knees, not through bombing, but through labor strikes.
Right.
And I think a lot of these plans and many, many more are things that are being thought of, operationalized, and things that we'll see in the coming weeks and months.
20 seconds. What do we need to still be doing that's frustrating you that we're not?
Well, I think Hormuz is the big issue, right? It's the choke point. About a third of oil right now is going through pipelines. That's good. Two-thirds is stuck. And Admiral Brad Cooper, head of CENTCOM right now, is using the U.S. military to try and decimate the remaining threat capabilities of the regime so we can open up that channel.
Yeah, blow up the mining boats. They say about 80% of those small boats are still out there, but they lost 16 last night. Mark, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Follow the latest information on the Foundation for Defense of Democracy's website. Politically, how's this playing? Rich Lowry next.
makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The new Supreme Leader is literally more conservative, more hardline. And since America and Israel has killed his father, his wife, and his kid, I'm not sure there's any room for negotiation. I think he is even more conservative and hardline than his father. And, you know, I don't know how he can stay in power and still think the Americans and our Israelis, we could meet any kind of long-term goals that wouldn't have an Iran that would constantly be trying to reconstitute.
Senator Warner, he kept using the term conservative. He should say radical. Radical. He used the term conservative. Unbelievable. Rich Lowry joins us now, editor of National Review. Rich, so I guess we replaced the a younger leader. We kill the older leader, we make the younger leader. So why do we bother? Is there really nothing else that he could see positive emerging out of this 12-day war with our 47-year-old enemy?
Yeah, look, we're obviously destroyed and decorated a lot of stuff. It'll take them years, presumably, to recover from this, even if it ends tomorrow. But the regime change, the goal of regime change, which, you know, the U.S. has been kind of ambiguous about, it's just very difficult to achieve from the air. So I think that the maximal upside scenario is, you know, whenever this ends, 2 weeks from now or whatever, that 6 months in the future, maybe there's a popular revolt and that works. But I think making it happen through this bombing campaign with immediacy, like we knock off various primary candidates and we get our guy to win the general election, that's not happening or is very hard to make happen.
Right. But the damage they've done to the ballistic missile capability, their nuclear program, and the killing of maybe 1,000 members of the IRGC, as well as up to 80 members of their ruling terroristic government, huge progress. And for the first time, we're standing up to this terroristic enemy.
Yeah, Trump broke the seal on what was a informal rule for four decades or more that the Iranians could hit us with their proxies, kill Americans, blow up Americans, maim Americans, but we couldn't hit directly back, you know, sanctions or whatever, or we'd hit their proxy forces, but we couldn't hit them directly, even though that was the head of the snake. He broke that seal last June with Midnight Hammer and has done it even more so here. Now, if the regime, the ultimate problem, Brian, is the regime, right? They only have a nuclear program because of the regime, right? And as long as this regime is in place, they're going to pursue nukes, they're going to try to build missiles and drones. So maybe, you know, 2 years from now, we have a version of the same problem, which isn't ideal, but we can, if we have to, we can hit them again.
And we would, and you know, Israel would too. We'll see if this government stays intact or if we see if I have a way to arm the people. Joe Rogan is among the Trump supporters that doesn't like this operation. And I want to hear on the other side what you would say to him. Cut 20.
Which just seems so insane based on what he ran on. I mean, this is why a lot of people feel betrayed, right? He ran on no more wars and these stupid, senseless wars, and then we have one that we can't even really clearly define why we did it.
Trump's been incredibly consistent how much he hates this regime.
And
Trump since 1980 has talked about, you know, during the hostage crisis, is like, let's go hit them, right? And he actually implied in that statement, let's go get their oil as well. So he's been very consistent about this. He said they can't have a nuclear program over and over and over again. So, and this is not going to be a forever war. We're not going to be on the ground in Iran for 20 years.
True. I want to talk about what's happening in New York. New York City has a terrorist attack right from ISIS. He actually said, give me a piece of paper. I will tell you, ISIS inspired me. We found out he lives in a very nice house, $2.5 million home over in Pennsylvania, one of these teens. They come together. We got him on video making detonators, and they show outside the mayor's house, and they tried to kill more people than the Boston bomber did. But yet we have a mayor here in New York City that doesn't seem to want to say that. And a network and CNN who wants to paint them as just two kids who had a bad afternoon. How do you explain this? We used to be clear on what a threat was.
Well, it's just it's a threat to their narrative. They don't like the idea that it wasn't the Islamophobe, as they call him, Jake Lang, I have very little use for, who is the threat to public safety. It was Muslim radicals who are throwing bombs on the streets of New York City, so they can't handle it, so they either ignore it or they suggest that Jake Lang caused the problem, or they minimize it. There's that outrageous, you know, worthy of a parody CNN tweet about this. You know, two young Muslim men take a stroll on a nice day in New York City, and lo and behold, you know, bombs end up thrown. How did that happen? And then you had Abby Phillip last night suggesting, doing a read, suggesting these bombs were directed at Mamdani instead of directing at the guys who were protesting against Mamdani. So it's scandalous. The only upside is that we have more means to discern the truth ourselves than ever before, because you just see the video instantly, so you don't have to believe what they write or put in their headlines.
Yeah, I mean, this is basically what CNN put up. Two Pennsylvania teenagers crossed into New York City Saturday morning for what would have been a normal day, enjoying the city during abnormally warm times. But in less than an hour, their lives would drastically change. What happened? Did they get hit by a bus? Did they pick up $5 million in the street? No. The pair would be arrested for throwing homemade bombs during an anti-Muslim outside protest, Mayor Mamdani's home. Here's what we know so far. Really? I mean, it just so happened, so unlucky, they happened to throw bombs because there was an anti-Muslim protest outside Mayor Mamdani's Gracie Mansion. So how do you get away with that?
Yeah, well, at least they deleted it and have been shamed. But they made it sound like these guys were just heading to brunch when all of a sudden the bombs got thrown. You know, it's like saying that the September 11th hijackers were on a flight from Boston and just happened to run into a skyscraper. I mean, it's ridiculous and disgraceful, but it's what we have. And the media has been corrupt for a very long time and not getting any better.
Right. So they went and corrected it, and they said a post regarding the two individuals arrested for throwing a homemade bomb outside a New York City mayor's house failed to reflect the gravity of the incident, thereby breaching the editorial standards we require for our reporting, and has therefore been deleted. Seth Dillon, the CEO of the Babylon Bee, you know, the satirical newspaper, said this about that tweet. Cut 46.
It's one of those examples where you run across something real and you have to double check, like, did this come from an actual news organization or is this satire? Because you read that and it does sound like something that we might write, making fun of a news organization that is unable to report the truth, unwilling to report the truth. So, you know, it's kind of funny on its face at first when you glance at it, and then you realize, wait, this came from CNN. And I think it's funny how, you know, CNN is like extremely similar to us in the sense that they publish funny fake news, but the difference is we actually admit that we're joking. You know, like we are trying to joke. They're actually trying to be serious with it. So that's the main distinction. Plus, our stories come true sometimes, which I guess is another distinction.
He's so good. Seth is so good. Babylon Bee is so good. He's absolutely on the mark. The other thing I wondered, was this AI initially, was a video of the counter protester braying on his bullhorn about how everyone's welcome in New York City. We're so open. We don't like outsiders telling us who can come in and who can come out. And immediately an Islamic radical throws a bomb over his head. I mean, he would have been the first one blown up. And then for days now, he's been inveighing against Jake Lang rather than the guy who tried to kill or maim him.
It's nuts. And then he has that clown from Colombia over for Ramadan dinner, who spent all his time protesting against the Israelis and got when he should have been graduating out of college. So I'm just going to give you an idea, the New York Times. So we have a lot to discuss here, right? But every single one of their headlines is negative. Three ships hit along vital oil route. Okay. How Trump and his adversaries and his advisors miscalculated Iran's response to war. At least 17 U.S. sites damaged in war with Iran. Trump directs war with the markets top of his mind. The war with Iran has changed the world in a week. U.S. gas prices jump. 85% of all these headlines are negative. You would never know that for 12 straight days, we have beat the hell out of this country, destroyed their ballistic missile capabilities, wiped out two-thirds of their launchers, killed as many as 80 of their leaders, have strangled their oil, stopped China from exporting and using their cheap oil on ghost ships. But they refuse to even look at anything positive about this conflict.
Yeah, it's sheer defeatism and kind of wishfulness, hoping it goes wrong. My favorite item from the New York Times coverage last week was they had a headline, "War Widens to Azerbaijan." I was like, oh my gosh, you know, what's happened in Asia, Azerbaijan? It was one missile. One missile from Iran. There hasn't been any missiles directed to Azerbaijan since then. And this is just the coverage you get. Now, look, the Strait of Hormuz is a big deal. You know, we need to find a way to open that up. And that's a big problem. So, you know, coverage and analysis, that's legit. But really, everything's negative. There's nothing positive that's happened.
So real quick, the Save America Act, which is really getting voter ID passed. Senator Thune says, what do you want me to do about it? I don't have the votes. The president's upset at Senator Thune, but he doesn't have the votes. If they do a talking filibuster, it's going to end up being all about January 6th or, you know, the Epstein files when the Democrats get a chance to talk. So what breaks this deadlock? Because even though 80% of the American people want to see voter ID, Democrats will not budge on this, it seems.
Yeah, so I don't think anything's breaking the deadlock. I think Thune will make every effort to show he's trying as hard as he can, but it's not going to pass the Senate. I think it'd be a big mistake to eliminate the filibuster over this. If you tried, I don't think you have the Republican votes to eliminate the filibuster to try to get this passed. But even if you did, it could come back to bite you so quickly because the extreme likelihood the Republicans aren't going to control the House next year. So you're not going to be able to pass anything anyway. So if you eliminate the filibuster, you just have this gun sitting on the table for Democrats potentially to use if they have unified control, God forbid, in 28. So I just think it's not going to pass. And in the meantime, Republicans need to try to do everything they can to agitate for more states, a lot of which already have voter ID. I mean, it's a complete common sense measure, but to try to get the laggards to come along, too.
Rich Lowry, thanks so much. National Review, appreciate it.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Can you tell me what is queering the map?
So I think we were trying to make the maps more gay.
Literally?
How
do you make a map more gay?
I mean, especially
more gay at all.
You know, since the age of cartography, we've had pretty good maps, but maybe they weren't gay enough. So I know also I took critical theory in college. I think sometimes people use queer as a verb. I do understand that the maps that we were trying to make gay were, I think, of Czechia and Slovakia. So maybe those countries asked for it. I doubt it, but I don't know.
So that is something from the State Department, Sarah Rogers, at one point and during a hearing, they were just talking about the political correctness at the State Department, how those days are done. But they were actually trying to make maps more gay.
Yes.
I mean, doesn't that sound like something on the Babylon Bee?
Yeah, the queering of the maps. It's insane.
Right.
And actually,
have you ever heard the term queering?
I have not until actually yesterday when I first heard the cut.
I originally thought when I saw it on the Five yesterday and I said, clearing the maps, how do you clear a map? And then it's queering a map. So, I mean, this is just some of the craziness that people have to vote on in November. You want some of this crap? You want all this stuff back? You want to living every day and getting buying green credits and being told you can't buy gas powered cars and you, you know, the men should be playing in women's sports. That's the type of the craziness that could be happening if you don't watch yourself.
So, Brian, that was one of the grants. Some other grants in this was a DEI flash mob in Kyrgyzstan, a diversity roadshow in India, diversity and inclusion programs in Luxembourg, Spain, New Zealand, Canada, Malaysia, teaching trans and intersex leaders in India. Just some of the other grants we put out there.
It's just crazy. And that's why USAID was collapsed. There's no doubt about it. So we're seeing some of this craziness. CNN also, Abby Phillips had to walk back some of the things they said, soft peddling the ISIS-inspired bombing that took place over the weekend. For some reason, CNN really does not want to give ISIS credit. They're begging to get credit for it. Yes, being terrorists. They want these two want to spend the rest of their lives in prison, these teenagers. I don't buy the fact that their parents are saying, you know, he usually calls me every 10 minutes and he didn't call one time. So I put down for missing person. Turns out he's in New York City hailing bombs at people, trying to kill as many as possible. How is it? I know there are bad parents out there, but those parents, nobody could be that oblivious, especially when they're allowed to go visit Saudi Arabia and Egypt. There was a time where we had such great relationships with intelligence in other countries that if we had an American visiting a known terror area like the Boston bombers, the FBI was informed of the Boston bombers and where those areas they were going to, where terrorist activity took place. They just didn't act in time. But I ask you, I mean, do we have anything still in place to stop the next bombing? I mean, that's the key. And do we have a mayor that'll admit it? It's Islamic extremists. Man, wouldn't it be great to have a Muslim mayor, someone in power, and say, hey, that doesn't represent me. I know the religion, and those people would never be allowed in my mosque, and would they'd be outed by the other parishioners or whatever they're called. But no, we don't see that. And you also see the situation I keep hearing about Sharia law popping up in these predominantly Muslim communities. That can't happen in America. Cut 43, Speaker Johnson.
When you seek to come to a country and not assimilate, but to impose Sharia law is in conflict with the U.S. Constitution. That is the conflict that people are talking about. It is not about people as Muslims. It's about those who seek to impose a different belief system that is in direct conflict with the Constitution. That's where I think that comes from.
Yeah, if you want to live here and be an American, I don't care what religion you are. If you want to come here and change America to something that your religion or your handbook says you should, please don't come and definitely don't stay. Here's Rebecca Weiner. She's the Deputy Commissioner of Intelligence and Counterterrorism on why young people are susceptible to this radicalization and how our investigators should be on the lookout for things just like what happened over the weekend, if possible, to stop it. Cut 44.
This is very much in keeping with a trend that we are seeing among ISIS-inspired adherents, both in the country as well as throughout the West. Younger and younger individuals who are radicalizing and mobilizing to violence. And this is taking place against the backdrop of social media, the dynamics of online culture. It's not limited to ISIS. It's across the ideological spectrum. Younger people mobilizing to violence, something we're tracking very closely.
I hope so. Not close enough. We didn't pick up these two. Now, the lawyer came out over the weekend and said, look, these two didn't even have a relationship. They didn't go to the same school. They don't hang with the same people. They're not from the same town. But then it turns out they're together buying detonators. They're caught on film. I don't know. Were they put together by ISIS? I mean, we already saw a situation where people say, you know, there was an assassination attempt on Donald Trump's life, but it wasn't Iranian. Well, it turns out Iranians are poaching Pakistanis or those susceptible and saying, we'll kill your family unless you go kill the president or kill the Iranian journalist over in Brooklyn, New York. That's when or Staten Island, New York. That's one thing we had heard, you know, see the Iranian activist and she has a very big curly hair. They were trying to kill her. So Iran has no problem doing it. And look, someone's been radicalized. They went for our embassy over in Toronto. Yesterday, we got these guys on tape trying to firebomb our embassy. We know they're trying to aim for our real estate over in Iraq, where our embassy is there. So they know where to find us, and it's Iran. They don't necessarily do it with Iranians. There are people that they pay, hitmen, or people that they essentially extort. That's the story. So, hey, go to BrianKilmeade.com. Find out how to see me. Coming up May 30th, we bring the show to the stage. You will love it over in Reno, Nevada. And, of course, you can go to BrianKilmeade.com for tickets. It's streamed on Fox Nation, but there's nothing better than seeing it in person. And don't forget to follow us on our YouTube page. Just go to Brian Kilmeade Show, at the Brian Kilmeade Show. And then you could see what we're doing all day, radio and more.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's Brian Kilmeade from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, where just blocks away we had a terror attack. And you have CNN and all these other newspapers and media outlets trying to downplay it. We will not. Especially 25 years since 9/11, coming up on September 11th. The NYPD gets it. The commissioner gets it. This mayor is trying to avoid it if, in fact, he does understand it. Rich Lowry was with us last hour. I'm thinking about this hour. We should move ahead. We've got a great roster of guests. This hour, hope we get it all in. Michael Allen is standing by, Managing Director of Beacon Global Strategies, former National Security Council Senior Director for George W. Bush. And then we got Congressman Brian Mass, Foreign Affairs Committee, is really zoned in on the war. And then we'll do a simulcast with Stuart Varney. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This was a vile protest rooted in white supremacy entitled Stop the Islamic Takeover of New York City. I'm the first Muslim mayor of our city. Anti-Muslim bigotry is nothing new to me.
You're missing the story, Mayor. Mandami's anti-Semitic Muslim. Well, you had one of them over for dinner while Islamic extremism attacks us here at home. New Yorkers have never been more vulnerable.
Number two.
President Trump wants the Department of Homeland Security. He wants TSA. He wants FEMA. He wants the brave men and women of our United States Coast Guard to receive their paychecks. And he wants this department to be fully funded and fully reopened.
And that is what Caroline Leavitt says. Pay them. Dems continue to keep DHS unfunded. And it's confounding. TSA workers, no paychecks. Some bizarre irrational stand on ICE will not fly. America is not zoned into ICE right now. DHS and the Democrats, get back to work.
Number one.
Are they more formidable than you anticipated, General?
I think they're fighting, and I respect that, but I don't think they're more formidable than what we thought.
Yes, not. General Dan Kane weighing in. Day 12 of Epicurie. We talk energy. Getting Hormuz straight and retaliation still exist, as the courage of a defecting soccer team should inspire all Iranians. And I hope a lot of people to stand up and take their country back. So far, there's been 2,100 Shahed drones being shot out of Iran, and they did hit two or three civilian vessels outside the Strait of Hormuz. I'm not sure what that's going to do the price of oil, not help it. We're blowing up the mining boats, but let's see what it will take to get that passageway reopened again. A lot of it's insurance, because people don't want to take the risk. Let's bring in the former National Security Council head, Michael Allen. Michael, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Michael, first off, your thoughts about where we're at 12 days in. I talked to you at 8 days in. Where do you think now?
Well, I think we've made good progress on the stated objectives. First and foremost, to degrade Iran's ability to project military power, and also to destroy the vestiges of their military, of their nuclear program. Things are getting more complicated, though. Of course, I think it was in the Iranians' playbook, and we knew they would do it, but they would come after the United States around the region, and they've had some unfortunate success in that area. And they're also doing what we expected in the Straits of Hormuz. They are trying to use all cards that they have to put pressure on the United States, either by way of sending U.S. troops home in body bags or trying to raise the price of oil to put pressure on President Trump to stop the campaign.
Right. And when they hit the oil field over in Saudi Arabia, they hit some desalinization configurations over in Bahrain. And they're trying to, you know, they hit some civilian sites to try to freak out the population. Do you think it's time for some of the Gulf states to take offensive action?
So I don't think we need their help, but I'm a little surprised that they didn't want to get out there and do it, at least to demonstrate to their publics that they're tough and they're not going to take this lying down. I hope to read very, very soon that we're able to use their airspace, that they are lending us any other assistance or logistical support that we might need. So I think it would be powerful symbolically. I still hope they would do it. I don't know that we need it militarily, but if I were them, I would do it.
I guess it shows their population they're willing to fight. I think that's important, too. For the Iranians, I think the next phase is we're going to start slamming them in the heartland, going after the Revolutionary Guard forces, as well as the besieged. And then we're going to have a question of, do we take that oil island that they have? Because that's where almost all the oil is processed. Do you think that the Israelis and the U.S. forces can do a job on the ground without being on the ground?
Well, I think it's going to be really difficult for them to take Karg Island. This is essentially the big shipping logistics hub for Iran. It's not that it's so difficult militarily, but what kind of issues does that raise in terms of spiking oil? Do the Iranians begin to sabotage some of their own equipment? Does that mean we have a further gain in the Iran in the oil market abroad? So I think we have to be careful to make sure that we're approaching this particular energy asset smartly, because if we have regime change, it's a big if and maybe a long shot, we need most of their oil infrastructure to work for a new government that we want to succeed.
So what would be hard about taking Karg Island? The adjustment of controlling the oil?
Yeah, I think so. Make sure that they don't sabotage it. I have heard that the Navy if we're going to do sort of a landing, needs different types of ships. That's not to say we couldn't parachute people in there to try and seize the right part of it. But if they see us coming, I think they may think to themselves, well, we need to figure out a way to throw away the key to this place so that the Americans can't control it in the long term. Now, we have some of the most sophisticated troops in the world, so maybe we can figure out a way to forestall this. But we have to think of sort of the geopolitical and pricing implications that it would raise if we did it.
I laughed at the headline in the New York Times today. It says America was surprised at the Strait of Hormuz was going to be an issue when they started this. I mean, so they teach you that in 11th grade social studies, like where most of the oil comes from and some of the challenges in the region. They anticipated it. The question is, what can we do to start escorting ships or mitigating it? Correct?
Exactly. And I've been trying to figure out, do a little work on this myself and talk to an admiral recently who has some experience in this. I think the position of the U.S. Navy is they really need to do this in 2 or 3 weeks because we need to further degrade the targets near the straits to ensure not only that there are no drones, but any other way, missiles, short-range ballistic missiles, ways for the regime to attack as we passed through the straits. So the Navy, I believe, is saying something to the effect of, yes, sir, we can do this. We've been planning on this for years and years, but security needs to improve before we take on this mission. It's not simply just escorting a tanker or two down a tough strait of water.
Michael, I think one of the key elements of this fight is that right now the Iranians have no ability to regenerate any of their rockets, missiles, or drones. They can't make them anymore. So what they have is what they have, whether it's big or small or diminished or not. This is what they have. They're not going to be able to continue production. How does that affect the strategy?
Well, I think it helps us tremendously because as we further degrade their ballistic missiles capability, that helps, one, our bases, our people in the region. Two, it helps Israel. Their ballistic missile program is, of course, a system of systems. They have, as you say, factories. They have assembly places. They have places they hide it. They have launchers. That's why it's taking so long. And we need to give this campaign another 2 to 3 weeks to continue to degrade the ability of the Iranians to be able to shoot off the missiles. And when we have finally achieved this, I think the United States is going to be in a much safer position, and the region will be in a much safer position.
Working with Boy George W. Bush during the Iraq War, you know what it's like having people almost cheering against you? It was nuts, not in the beginning, but certainly at the end. Everybody knows the war's lost, Harry Reid. Meanwhile, the surge happened, and you guys actually won the war. Barack Obama threw it away when he pulled all the troops out. But I want you to hear some of that right now. Here is Richard Blumenthal, Cut 12.
I emerged from this briefing as dissatisfied and angry, frankly, as I have from any past briefing in my 15 years in the Senate.
Really? Because the Republicans came out feeling well-briefed, and he came out feeling this way. Cut 13.
I am fearful. That's the path that we're on right now. Literally, Russia seems to be aiding our enemy actively and intensively with intelligence and perhaps with other means, and China also.
So does anyone think that Russia isn't always working against us? And that's been the case since the end of World War II. But go ahead, Michael. You know what it's like hearing this.
Yeah, we've been talking about the axis of upheaval for a few years now. We know that the Iranians and the Russians are as thick as thieves. Yeah, I thought that was a cheap shot, of course, from the senator. The administration is briefing the right members of Congress, especially on the committees and the Gang of Eight, those that are in the senior leadership position, on a lot of different detail. I think that it's really not a tough call to make that we're succeeding so far in our objectives. We talked about nuclear. We talked about their conventional military infrastructure that we're degrading. So I think we're doing very well so far. I see the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff briefing the nation from the podium. I'm so glad to see that. So I think we're the administration's really getting out there and explaining this to the American people.
I know it's a difficult job, and when you make decisions, you're always going to have critics, regardless. And yet people also, like, I look at the squad, I think they're rooting for the other team almost on a daily basis. I really do. Others try to play it, you know, and see political advantage. When I look at Senator Warner, Senator Kelly, people that have been briefed to the highest levels, Democrats and Republicans for decades, and they're pretending as if Iran wasn't a problem that we had to deal with every day. But I want you to hear Jake Sullivan. People say he's brilliant. I thought it was some of the worst foreign policy decisions in my lifetime. But he feels bold enough to talk. Cut 10.
When you engage in diplomacy, even with your most implacable adversary, and you make a demand of them, and you say, do this, and I will give you nothing for it, the odds that they're going to say, okay, sure, I'll go along with that, are quite low, even in the face of a military threat. So I think any diplomacy with Iran will have to involve a quid for the quo, will have to involve some measure of sanctions relief. Now, that can be metered, it can be tied to performance metrics. But I think it is not logical to think we could have a diplomatic deal that didn't involve the U.S. engaging in some form of sanctions relief. I think that has been true in diplomacy since time immemorial.
So do you think that?
I think that he's being disingenuous here because he's presuming that the Iranians wanted to reach a deal with us. They didn't want to reach a deal with the Biden administration. They embarrassingly bent over backwards the entire term to try and get them back into the Obama-era Iran deal. Iran stiffed them. They didn't hardly talk to them. They wanted nothing to do with all the blandishments that the Biden administration was trying to offer the Iranian regime. And we are offering our team, the Trump administration, was offering them at least two things. We won't strike you militarily. And there was the implicit thought that you would eventually get some sanctions relief. So I think he's off base and being disingenuous on this. Plus, listen to Steve Witkoff. He says he was in the meetings with the Iranians and didn't believe they were serious at all. I don't think it was in their nature to compromise. They were never going to do it. And this is the path we're on.
And Michael, would have believed that what he said, and I do, Steve Witkoff said, they said they had 400 plus kilograms of uranium enriched, and they had enough to make 11 bombs. That's really not a great way to start productive talks. Here's more from Jake Sullivan, cut 8.
I do not believe that this has made America safer. And I don't think that those tactical gains are actually going to convert into long-term security gains for the United States, not by a long shot. Joe asked me to kind of gamely make the positive case. And I think the most positive thing you can say is we made some tactical operational gains because we have a very effective military. I think strategically, this has so far been a huge setback for the United States because all of the advances, we've made no advances in this war on the nuclear program, as I've said, and the advances we've made on their conventional capabilities can be reversed relatively rapidly by Iran reconstituting its ballistic missile program and its drone program. So I think it's incremental on the gain side, and it's significant on the cost side.
Well, listen, they have a ballistic missile program. We have to degrade it. That's what we're doing here. It's true. Maybe later down the road, we're going to have to continue to make sure Iran is in a box and can't threaten the United States and our interests in the region. But it doesn't make any sense just to say we're going to do nothing. It doesn't make any sense for us to just get back and try and beg the Iranians to get into some sort of arrangement with us, especially given their track record of cheating. So I think he's wrongheaded about it. He's looking for ways to fault the president, and I don't really think it's persuasive whatsoever.
Michael, how about the fact that as long as you leave Iran in power and flush with money, Hezbollah and Hamas will always be a problem, and there'll be unrest in a roiled Middle East, especially with our Israeli ally. And then you extrapolate that out. They don't really consider Israel an ally. Jake Sullivan was not working with Netanyahu, barely at all.
That's right. That's right. They were trying to figure out ways that they could criticize Israel in the middle of a war. And I don't know if they intended to do this or not, but they gave comfort to Hamas because Hamas didn't feel like they needed to compromise as long as the Biden administration was known to be unhappy with Netanyahu or was just outright criticizing them. So through their own hubris, they extended the war And so I'm not sure they have a lot of qualifications here to talk about how to get rid of the head of the snake, which
yes.
ultimately funds.
They fed the snake. Michael yeah. Allen, thanks so much. And
Thank
I guess
Jay,
I wanted to play it, but Jake Sullivan, as they say, sit this one out. Back in a moment. Thanks, Mike.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Trump's addiction to chaos is going to come back, is coming back to haunt the United States. The most formidable weapon Iran has right now is the Strait of Hormuz, which today is effectively shut down. And now, thanks to Donald Trump's lack of foresight, Iran has a new, even more radical, even more hostile supreme leader who will not be inclined to give up leverage over the Strait. That's the one weapon that Iran has where it can be, unfortunately, be successful.
So this Senator Chuck Schumer of New York, the great military strategist, is now breaking down where the war is, rooting against it, the success for 12 days. Everybody knew that Ayatollah's son was the heir apparent. But the problem, the only reason he wouldn't have done it, is because they thought he was too much of a knucklehead to actually get the job. He had no leadership ability. He was a veteran, but just loved cracking down on people and doing international real estate deals. So him being replaced was inevitable. The fact that he's wounded, we wiped out 80 other henchmen in their government. Do you not bring that up? Wiping out the ballistic missile program, has that come into your mouth?
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I think you're starting to see the U.S. is really showing that we have naval mastery in the most critical choke point in the region. And the Iranians are increasingly, they certainly have some asymmetric options, as I said, but we're increasingly showing that they're going to have a limited ability going forward to use what they've long said was kind of their ace in the hole.
And that is Alex Gray, the former NSC chief under Trump in the first term, talking about where we're at now, 12 days in. I want to get the perspective of Congressman Brian Mast. He's on their Foreign Relations Committee, extremely respected, not only for fighting wars, but his analysis of the challenges overseas. Congressman, are we where you thought we would be 12 days in?
I think we are in a very good place. I can't say that 12 days ago, I had an expectation of exactly where we would be in 12 days. But what I could say about that in a more specific way is 12 days in, we've hit 5,500 plus targets very, very precisely. All of these different Navy vessels with various capabilities, not just in the Straits of Hormuz, but in a number of different places across the region. Smaller vessels capable of deploying sea mines in the Straits of Hormuz. Military caches of these ballistic missiles that they want to fire at us. The systems that would actually fire them. There is a very strategic and methodical approach to each system that is being deployed. And the converse side that I would say of that is Iran has a capability to be very precise as well. We are precise. They are also precise, but they are precisely targeting merchant ships, container ships, oil ships, refineries, flying drones specifically at hotels and condo buildings. And so what we are being precise at are two very specifically different things.
So they are trying to rattle our Sunni neighbors, and they're trying to further alienate Saudi Arabia, UAE, Oman, and of course Qatar. And they're trying to hurt the economy and hurt oil production. I understand they just hit a Saudi oil field, which is going to go down for a while. So do you think that means we should pick up the pace in our bombing?
It's not just that we should, it's that we are. And, you know, you can hear General Kane speak about this very specifically about, and again, it's two things to talk about the converse side of one another. Their volume, their frequency of strikes, every moment is decreasing. Every day is decreasing. For the United States, our volume, our frequency is increasing, and it's moving into different waves that, you know, maybe on day one you couldn't hit this specific target because there was still a threat of surface-to-air coming out of Iran. Well, that threat is eliminated, so now you can move in further and hit this target that you didn't have access to before. Or now there was a threat of this specific drone cache. Now you've taken out that drone cache, so you can move on to this target. So the volume and frequency for us, again, very precise, very methodical to get to a certain point of destroying all Iranian military infrastructure that can reach out or has reached out and touched Americans. Their methodology, reach out and touch anything that they can, even though they could choose what they hit, but especially hitting their neighbors, oil refineries, vessels, and civilian locations.
So here's what some Democrats on the Senate side are saying. Cut 11.
There seems to be no end game.
I'm not sure what the end game is or what their plans are. They certainly have not made their case.
And so far, President Trump and the briefers from the Secretary Hegseth have not been clear about what the end game is.
What's the end game, Brian Mast?
Let me start by responding that just to say BS. Those statements are pure BS.
Why?
And they're significantly dangerous for them to say these things that they know are false. Why are they significantly dangerous? Because everything that they say gets amplified and echoed across the Middle East on a number of different outlets, whether it's BBC or Al Jazeera or anything else, and they are being incredibly irresponsible with their words. They have had numerous classified briefings where everything has been very, very specifically laid out, from General Kane to Secretary Hegseth to Secretary Rubio to Director of CIA John Radcliffe. They've had more meetings just besides these large group classified briefings that they have been a part of. And if they are members of the Senate or members of the House of Representatives that are involved at all in national security, and they are pretending that they do not know specifically what the threat emanating out of Iran has been and is today, then they have absolutely no business being a part of the national security apparatus, because they do know, they're being irresponsible with their words, and they're lying to the American people, and it's hurting this military operation for them to do.
Well, I know one thing, you know, in the opposition research, when they tried to find out what Iran was up to, they thought they could break our will and break the will of the Sunni states, the Gulf states, by making them pay a price, them pressuring us to end early. They've actually galvanized for now around us and got even angry at Iran. But they look at the divided home and they think that's their greatest strength. Does that sound familiar? Exactly like Hamas in Gaza, as the Biden administration turned on Netanyahu. It gave Hamas, along with their protest in America for the Palestinians, it gave Hamas energy and more.
I think you're nailing it. This is exactly what it is. And irresponsible is not even the right word for, again, these are individuals that are at the highest levels of the U.S. national security apparatus and access. And to be that flippant about things that they know are the exact opposite, It is not worthy of being in this time of war, time of conflict, defending this country. And let's bring it back a moment to something even earlier to make your point. So you remember when President Trump developed the Board of Peace to go out there initially, and he met with something like 35 countries, all came together in the Middle East, and they talked about how they were going to reshape what took place in Gaza. And at that meeting, you had essentially 35 nations all recognizing what is the number one largest instability in the Middle East, certainly, but across the globe. They all recognize that one instability is Iran, and they were all turning and focusing their attentions toward Iran, because that was the number one source of preventing stability and peace in the region. And that was even months ago. Now everybody is seeing exactly how this plays out when push comes to shove.
It absolutely is. Congressman, have you been in contact with any of your overseas contemporaries, lawmakers in Qatar, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait?
So as chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, all those individuals I mentioned already, our secretaries and our directors, in constant contact with them. As chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, constant contact with ambassadors across the region, whether they're ambassadors to the United States of America or our ambassadors to those specific countries. That's a very common conversation for me to have. But then a number of others, you know, friends of mine that I have still serving in the military that are in different posts, different places, that we, again, maybe not constant conversation, but being updated on what they're seeing and what they're doing. And so, but even beyond that, even if I had no friends from my time in service and I was nothing more than a rank and file member of Congress with no chairmanship, I can tell you that I would have been well versed on exactly what the mission is: destroy every piece of Iranian military hardware that's reached out and touch us or can reach out and touch us, and the individuals that will push the button to say fire, well versed on that and exactly what the threats are, even if I had no chairmanship and was a freshman member that had just came in.
I want to bring you back to March 5th. You had Sarah Rogers in front of you, and she let us know that making the political correctness has gone to the State Department and map making. Cut 65.
Can you tell me what is queering the map?
So I think we were trying to make the maps more gay.
Literally?
How do you make
a map more gay?
I mean, especially
or
with
gay
AI,
at all.
You know, since the age of cartography, we've had pretty good maps, but maybe they weren't gay enough. So I know also I took critical theory in college. I think sometimes people use queer as a verb. I do understand that the maps that we were trying to make gay were, I think, of Czechia and Slovakia. So maybe those countries asked for it. I doubt it, but I don't know.
What the hell is that about?
You can't make that up. And what you're hearing there about queering the map, which was a $72,000 grant, so a year's salary for somebody in the United States of America to make more queer or whatever they are, maps somewhere in Europe or wherever it is that they were doing this. That's how the Biden administration was spending your money. And that is one of a thousand crazy examples. And I'll tell you, after that took place, I probably had literally 100 text messages from people saying, is that AI? Is that real? There's no way that that's real. That's fake, right? Said, no, that's 100% real. And I can give you 1,000 other crazy examples of them paying, you know, $50,000 to do a flash mob, a queer flash mob in Kyrgyzstan, or a transgender job fair in Bangladesh, or, you know, things
crazy
that you have no idea how in the world the mind came up with this.
And crazy.
And instead of doing real national security, dealing with Iran or dealing with our southern border at the time, that's what the State Department was up to.
Chairman Mass, thanks so much. Exciting time. We need level heads like yours in there and also exposing some of this.
The Brian Kilmeade Show joins Fox Business's Varney & Company with Stuart Varney, live on your radio and on Fox Business. Here's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back. I guess Stuart Varney is still in commercial. We'll do a simulcast there. This time he told us to be ready. But we're going to do a simulcast on FBN. We're looking at a few things now. We'll have the latest in the war. It's unfolding. We're actually picking up the pace of the bombing. Also, the Strait of Hormuz. You have three separate ships hit in some way, shape, or form in around the Strait of Hormuz. That'll slow down traffic additionally. They worry about insurance for those ships to come through. Look, I think 20% of the world's oil comes through there. You know who gets 50% of the world's oil
through
there?
On the right-hand side of the screen,
China.
There he is.
So okay. Let's listen to Stuart.
All right, Brian. Listen to New York City Mayor Zohan Mamdani respond to a question about young people drawn to ISIS ideology. Watch this.
I was wondering if you had any, you know, words of advice to any young people who might find themselves being drawn to that particular ideology.
I think first and foremost, just to make it clear to everyone that extremism and hatred of any kind will not be tolerated in our city. And that is regardless of whatever ideology motivates any person to commit an act of violence, there is no tolerance for it here. There is no tolerance for any kind of violence within that vision of our city or the way in which we lead this city.
All right, Brian, I would call that a weak answer. Why can't he just flat out condemn ISIS or even condemn Hamas, the hostage takers?
You know what normally people go back to? Well, we don't know the ideology of the attacker. We don't know why they did what they did. We can only assume
yeah,
and get reports. No, he asked for a pen. one of the attackers. And I want to tell you, this is for ISIS. This is why we're doing it. If not me, there's going to be somebody else coming toward you. Proud of what they did. They're going to spend the rest of their life in prison, hopefully. And it's going to be a miserable experience. But sadly, we got to pay for it. And what an opportunity. You're a Muslim mayor. You're not a radical. They're Islamic. They are radical. Tell us the difference. Tell us how much harder it makes your job when people want to see that behavior and associate it with you. And I looked at the mayor of London, same thing. He never uses the many terroristic things that happen in there, in that city, to explain to people the difference and the damage that these radicals do to the perception of Islam, assuming they believe there's a difference. I assume he believes there's a difference. Now, you also have his wife, who liked 70 different anti-Israel posts, anti-Semitic posts, and they're just beginning to uncover that now, picked up in various publications. And then you have a situation where he just invited the lead radical at Columbia University over for brunch or dinner or lunch or lunch. Really? Out of all the people to invite over, you invite the one guy that radicalizes the campus of Columbia, that actually brought in a multi-million-dollar, if not a billion-dollar fine to that university, who really has lied on his visa why he came here, who they were referred to, this guy, they referred to him actually in Gaza. They knew exactly what he was doing. And that's the one the mayor has over to celebrate Ramadan. So
just not
this mayor has every opportunity to straighten things out. I think we're in for a really rough 4 years. 25 years since 9/11, we have a mayor that doesn't get the threat.
Well, it's been a rough start. That's a fact, Brian. One more for you. House Speaker Johnson says Republicans are in course correction mode after the ouster of Kristi Noem and some unfavorable polling. Brian, on deportations, do you think the GOP needs a course correction? Soften the policy a little. What do you think?
Yeah, they did it 3 weeks ago. You know, Tom Homan going in there. Kristi Noem was working off a different play sheet than Tom Homan would have. Sidelined Tom Homan, even though he's the one who sealed the border. And now he's front and center. President brought him back. He's course corrected. That's a story from a month ago, right? The president should go down to the border, bring the press with him, let everybody see what Kamala Harris couldn't do and wouldn't try to do, a closed border. And then you go through some cities and see some improvement in Nashville. You see some improvement over in Memphis. You see improvement in other places around the country where he's brought in the troops like Washington, D.C., where he's brought in the team to quell the crime in the country. It's course corrected. The people that are extending it is the DHS being shut down right now. TSA not getting paid right now because the Democrats overplaying their hand, saying right out, flat out, that if we don't get masks off the operators of ICE, if we don't get judicial warrants before any operation, they will not support the funding. That's what's killing ICE right now.
They want to cripple ICE. That's what's going on here. Brian, I'm sorry I'm out of time, but I want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for joining us earlier this week. Appreciate you, Stuart. Meanwhile, that's what we've been discussing. ICE, this was a story like 3.5 weeks ago. They did reform ICE. It's already been done. I mean, if Democrats had any brain in their head, brain cells left in their heads, they would say, wow, we really got a lot of what we wanted. Kristi Noem is out. Roving patrols are done. We are now doing a situation where ID numbers can go on uniforms, if not names, stuff like that. But they're not going to take their masks off. It's not possible. Face coverings. And number two, they are also, the president said, you know what? I'm not going to go into cities where we're not going to get cooperation. And he told that to Governor of New York, Hochul. These are all things where Senator Schumer can go up there and make some statement on some county steps or the Capitol steps and say, look at what we did, all right? But they're not doing it because they overplayed their hand. And now I think everybody understands the money's there. It was all agreed upon. You're trying to send a message for what happened in Minneapolis, much of which was good, some of which was bad, much of which was caused by a terrible governor and an awful mayor and no cooperation with local police. And you had ICE out there basically on their own with no perimeter. But all that stuff's been corrected. There's no question about it. And I just think the president never took the proper credit for what happened at the border. The other thing that Secretary Noem didn't do is spend the money to build the wall. Evidently, billions are sitting on her desk to finish off this wall that if it's not finished off under Trump, there's nobody that's going to do it. But it's not just a wall from the ancient Roman era. There's going to be high tech involved with it, sensors everywhere, work in conjunction with Border Patrol. And it's not going to be one wall. It's going to be a series. All right, you listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Make sure to check me out in Reno, Nevada. Go to BrianKilmeade.com for history, liberty, and laughs. We bring fun to the stage. Hopefully everyone will be able to join me there. Don't move.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. We have a lot coming up. Martha McCallum will be in studio shortly. Tom Carrico is here, too, senior fellow at the International Security Program and director of the Missile Defense Project at the Center for Strategic International Studies. Man, do we need that expertise? A lot going on. Three separate cargo vessels, various types, have been hit outside the Strait of Hormuz, and that has further curtailed traffic. So now I think the U.S. Navy is really considering and figuring out a way to start escorting ships and taking control. That is really the only economic vice that and move that Iran has, except for trying to hurt other Gulf states on not necessarily their military, not even going for our bases, but going for their energy sources. So, and by the way, they hit Saudi Arabia and Qatar effectively. One-stop natural gas, one-stop oil production for now. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
This was a vile protest rooted in white supremacy entitled Stop the Islamic Takeover of New York City.
Really?
I'm the first Muslim mayor of our city. Anti-Muslim bigotry is nothing new to me.
Ugh. The mayor, totally missing the mark. Islamic extremists toss IEDs at would-be New Yorkers, and he thinks it's about him. I'll explain.
Number two.
President Trump wants the Department of Homeland Security. He wants TSA. He wants FEMA. He wants the brave men and women of our United States Coast Guard to receive their paychecks. And he wants this department to be fully funded and fully reopened.
Wouldn't that be nice? Pay him. Dems continue to keep DHS unfunded. TSA workers and Coast Guard without paychecks by some bizarre, irrational stand against ICE. Why this has to end this week.
Number one.
Are they more formidable than you anticipated, General?
I think they're fighting, and I respect that, but I don't think they're more formidable than what we thought.
Yes, that is true. General, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Dan Kane, day 12 of Epic Fury. We talk energy, getting Hormuz open, straight open, and retaliation. Yes, it still exists, but people are missing it, like the entire staff of the New York Times. We're on the offensive. We are knocking the hell out of them in every way, shape, or form. They have the inability to regenerate any of their ballistic missiles, short, medium, and long, as well as a 50-boat Navy now at the bottom of the sea. Yes, there's stuff to do. But please notice who's winning. Tom Carrico joins us now. Tom, how would you characterize where we're at right now in this conflict?
Hey, good morning, Brian. It's been a busy week, as you said, for a lot of these segments. You noted the absolute dominance on the naval front. There is air superiority. There's been a lot of, I would say, justified concern for the first 4 or 5 days about the number of long-range missiles that we were expending and the number of missile defense interceptors that we were expending, which is why when Dan Kane gave a press conference the other day, the two most important words I heard him say were munitions transition, which is that we, having gotten air superiority, we're now able to move from the exquisite and scarce long-range standoff missiles like Tomahawk to basically gravity bombs to be able to fly over. Brian, you said there at the beginning that they're moving to not merely degrade, but really destroy the missile program. I think that is one of the best articulations of what it is we're trying to do here. During the 12-day war last year, we expended a ton of missile defense interceptors. So did the Israelis. We both have done that again this year. But because and the reason we're doing it this year is that we didn't finish the job last time. And so if we don't go and finish the job, to your point, if we don't no-kidding completely eliminate it, then they're just going to rebuild, and we're going to be doing this again in another 9 months or another 12 months. And I think that's basically the most important thing that I'm watching for is, are we looking to give the Iranian regime off ramps? I hope that's not the case. I don't think the Israelis want to do it this time.
What about,
I think they were kind of
What about the Gulf states?
You know, that's kind of the dog that isn't barking here. I'm a little bit it's a little bit of a head scratcher that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, who for so long had quite the ambition, and the there's no love lost between them and Iran over the years. They're probably letting us use facilities and things like that, but I'm a little surprised that they're not in the air and doing some of this themselves. So maybe there's some complex diplomacy there. But the other interesting piece there is Iran, in a tactical method that I'm not quite understanding, is they kind of been lashing out at all of their neighbors. They were even shooting at Turkey, you know, a couple times, which we managed to intercept. So Iran's kind of lashing out at everybody. I think it would seem to make sense that they would kind of want to get on board and see this job through.
Couple of things. I'm talking to Tom Carrico, one of the station's premier experts when it comes to missile defense. So I know about the Arrow, know about David Sling, know about the Iron Dome. Now we're finding out about beam technology, laser technology, and it's playing a role off ships, and it's playing a role, we know, in Israel. Could you tell me about it, where we're at, and what limitations it may have?
Yeah, so the good news is that, you know, lasers are showing up on the battlefield. I would say lasers, but also high-powered microwaves of different varieties, which is to say different, and jammers, of course, have been out for a while, different non-kinetic ways to knock things out of the sky, especially on the lower-tier drone front. Israel announced that it had fielded and, I believe, used the Iron Beam laser in this conflict. There was some sort of statement by the IDF about that. There is, as you say, nevertheless, some limitations. You know, ships tend to have a lot of water vapor around them, and weather is a big limit on the use of lasers to penetrate weather and see things. So there will always be a need for chemically powered rockets to go kill other chemically powered rockets. But nevertheless, it's showing up, and for especially the cheap drones and things like that, given that it is also limited by the horizon, that's another limitation. For just about any kind of direct energy. So there are all those limits, and there will be a mix, a greater mix of kinetic and non-kinetic things going forward. That's all for the good. I think we have to have reasonable, kind of curb our expectations in terms of what we're going to get in the near term. But, yeah, I think there's been suggestions, and you saw the El Paso news item a couple weeks ago, Brian, about the tests of an American laser on the border to be ready to shoot down drug cartels' drones. And so, you know, there have been news reports about things like that showing up.
And Tom, do you think it's going to get better? Because it's so cost-effective, right? I mean, it's literally energy. There's no interceptors. Literally, you can the way I understand it, you just heat it up and it blows up, right?
Sure, and fairly instantaneously, if the object is not hardened against heat, like, you know, some missile reentry vehicles are. If they're hardened to reenter the atmosphere, they're going to be a little bit harder to melt, as it were, with a laser. But so it is going to get better. Again, there'll still be limitations by the horizon, and other limitations as well. It is, you know, the cost thing is an interesting thing, because you kind of got to keep your generator running, and you got to keep the system running, and you got to operate the system, you know, 24 hours a day, so that you can be able to take that $4 shot whenever something comes over the horizon. So the operational costs are not nothing to sneeze at, but, you know, those operational costs also apply to kinetic. Patriot battery has to have a generator, you know, next to it all the time.
What about, I understand that Ukraine has been like war university, and now they want to help our experts knock down the Shahed drones because how what they learned to do with doing it. What are the Ukrainians bringing? Why didn't we accept their help when they offered it?
Yeah, why the administration didn't jump on that is a bit of a surprise. Who knows? Is it hubris? Is it some sort of complex relationship with other things being negotiated, we don't know. But I think you're right. They've been in this for their lives and for their national existence, and as a result, they've figured out that, you know, when you're good at innovating when people are shooting at you, and as a result, the Ukrainians have been innovating on this and getting some capability, including really cheap stuff. You know, we hear about the 7 million drones that are being made a year. Most of them have a very short shelf life, very short life expectancy. And the reason is both the Ukrainians and the Russians' drones are being countered by various means. You see videos of guns and shotguns and other things, and there's just a whole heck of a lot of EW, electronic warfare, that's going on as well.
So are we in danger of running out of interceptors, or have we made the adjustment? Because the way I see it, I think they've sent out 2,100 Shahed drones to various Gulf nations and to Israel.
Yeah, that's a lot. Now, I will say that, frankly, I do think we are in danger of, as they say, going Winchester, of running out of our defensive interceptors, or maybe not running out, but at least getting dangerously low. And the reason it's dangerous is, you know, we need those things not just for Iran. We need those things to deter Chinese adventurism. And, you know, we've been talking about the need to pivot to the Pacific for about 10, 15 years.
We can't do it with Iran like this. This would be one of the big pivots if we could neutralize Iran once and for all.
Right. And we just don't want to also use up all of our weapons in the process. And so that's kind of the need to get this job done completely and to get it done fast. And so the best news is that we have slowed the rate of Iranian missile launches, presumably by hitting the launchers on the ground or what have you. And that's a good trend, but it is also a bit of a it is a worry, I will say, that we are the Israeli friends and also all the other Gulf states that operate Patriot, for instance, or operate THAAD, that the number of missiles they're having to shoot down is eating into their inventories. Now, if we, as it were, solve the Iran problem, I'm less worried about the folks in the Middle East, their long term. But I do worry about, you know, the United States, because we got lots of other theaters to contend with.
Do you believe we had to do this? This confrontation had to happen somewhere, somehow.
I would say that there is certainly the military logic of, I will call it, a preventive war, that because we didn't finish the job last summer, because, as Secretary Rubio said, I think this is the best formulation. What Secretary Rubio said after one of the Gang of Eight meetings is, time was not on our side. That the Iranians were building up the missiles and building up the drones.
Two separate sides.
Yeah, kind of inevitable that we were going to have to do this, and so it was. Time was not on our side, and from that standpoint, I'm gratified to see it. I just want to make sure that the job is done through.
Right, and if you are. Is there things we can do to defend oil and gas fields in our Gulf states, for our Gulf states, that they're not doing? Desalinization plants, anything.
Right. You know, look, it really comes down to active or passive defense. Passive defense hardening is difficult, in as much as there's a lot of soft targets on things that you're talking about that are hard. You can't exactly put concrete over everything. And then in terms of the active defense, you know, everybody talks about using a $4 million Patriot interceptor against a $40,000 drone. But actually, that's not what's shooting down most of these drones. Most of these drones are being shot down are probably with some kind of counter UAS effector. It could be guns. It could be the Coyote UAS interceptor that's been shooting down a lot of these things. So there's other things besides Patriot, and there's less costly things. Look, this has been a high interest item for a number of states in the Middle East. They've seen this problem coming for a long time, and there's been a lot of investments on the counter UAS front. Will there ever be enough? No. You can never defend everything, and that's a challenge. And so you do have to pick and decide what you most want to defend and where you put your defensive assets. And that's always a hard problem.
Absolutely. But I do think there's going to be a lot more interest in the Golden Dome after this, when this conflict is done. And the president says it's definitely plausible. We'll need bipartisan buy-in to fully implement it. There was a time in which missile defense was a pipe dream that Rumsfeld had no business asking for. Now we all expect it. Tom Carrico, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everyone. Martha McCallum's here. Martha's guy who can't wait for her show at 3 o'clock. It's been on in the morning, and we're covering all the breaking news as it has to do with the war, especially. But we also have the problem with terror in New York City. And I'm just going to, Martha, I was just amazed, and I shouldn't be. The New York Times is like the top 12 stories, 10 of which are negative. You would think that we are at a, we have had hit one target.
I know.
We haven't killed 80 leaders in, we have not wiped out their Navy. All I'm seeing is doom and gloom from the New York Times and the Washington Post. I am surprised because I thought in the beginning of a conflict that 47 years in the making, there would be some understanding of it.
Yeah, you would think that. And I would guarantee that you could go back and we could do this later and look for headlines from the New York Times talking about the threat that is presented by the Iranian regime, talking about what happened to our Marines in Beirut in the 1980s, what happened in all of these attacks that they've promulgated across the region, the largest source of terrorism around the world. Those headlines exist too, but they seem to be have fallen far back into the ether of their minds. And, you know, it is, it's an anti-Trump media philosophy. It's like exhausting to keep, you know, saying it, but that's what it is. And it's an inability to look at the story in an objective way and report what's going on.
So how about this? 32 countries to release, this is good news, 32 countries to release 400 million barrels of oil from their strategic oil reserves. So Wall Street Journal had this. At least, here's the others. At least 17 U.S. sites damaged in war with Iran. How Trump and his advisors miscalculated Iran's response to war. U.S. is at fault on the strike on the school in Iran. We don't really see anything about the Iranian soccer team, who is about to be persecuted, as most of which arrived back. New Iranian leader was wounded early in the war. Iran and Israeli officials say, I guess they're hoping for him to recover. You know, so almost every story is negative. Look, find out who hit the school, but also understand the regime is the what they've done and how they've acted that brought us to this point, especially Donald Trump, who actually identified Iran as the problem, but he was the one who's took action, had direct talks on the nuclear program. You know, Joe Biden tried to get talks, gave them everything, and never got his sit down.
Well, we have a long record of presidents who have been alarming the nation about the threat that Iran presents. But the problem is, you know, until you have a president, and whether you agree with his action or not, who is willing to take a bold action, you will never have a catalyst for history. Now, we know that we don't have a good record at regime change, really, since World War II and Panama.
I don't think anybody
like the
does.
Two examples. Yeah. It is a huge undertaking. The president early on said that that was what he was interested in. Now, you know, I think what we're going to find is that they're going to figure out ways to inspire the opposition in Iran to try to put someone to, you know, in this leadership position that can make do some reform and can rebuild the country. And the president set these military targets. But I mean, my gosh, like, I mean, my whole life, all I ever heard was how dangerous Iran is. The world's largest sponsor of terrorism. We've watched as they have blown up our soldiers, maimed them, killed the Marines in Beirut, and the list goes on and on. Eventually, we have to shake up the dynamic here, and that's something that President Trump was the only one who was willing to do.
And he said, I'm not going to leave it for the next guy.
Right.
And he said, I'm going to do it.
I think he just has, like, in his head that he has this timeline that is ticking, and he wants to do the things that are on his list.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Which just seems so insane based on what he ran on. I mean, this is why a lot of people feel betrayed, right? He ran on no more wars and these stupid, senseless wars. And then we have one that we can't even really clearly define why we did it.
That is Joe Rogan yesterday, which a lot of channels are running with. He feels betrayed about why we're in the Iran war. With me right now is Martha McCallum. Her show's coming up at 3 o'clock today. But you have people on the cusp. in the podcast world that are upset by this. Tim Dillon, a comedian, he said, well, we shouldn't be in this war in Iran, and some others. Martha, you've heard that on the right. I cannot believe Senator Warner, Senator Kelly, Senator Shaheen, they're all against this war, even though they know that for the last 47 years, Iran's been the problem. They've been afraid to confront.
Well, I think that's exactly right. I think that everybody who has been able to call out the Iranian regime has been afraid to confront it. I think President Trump sees, that the clock ticks on his time in office and that he wants to be a consequential, historic president. And I think that he puts that before his concerns about the midterms at the moment. I think he is probably, wants to make sure that oil prices come down and perhaps that they have enough time before November to kind of make the conversation about something different by the time we get closer to that. You're always going to have anti-war isolationists in any point in history. We certainly had them before World War II. There was a huge reluctance in this country to get involved. And Churchill had to convince President Roosevelt to do the lend-lease, because there was so much pushback after World War One, a concern of getting involved, even though there was this clear and present danger that existed in Hitler and a clear and present danger that exists in Iran. So, you don't always have, you have people who have the guts to take action and then you have people who are isolationists. It's as old as countries.
Right. And the president is saying, part of the reason why they say, tell me your objective and tell me the reason. There are so many reasons. Mm-hmm. So what are your objectives? Well, the ballistic missile program, absolutely, we're destroying it. The nuclear program, that's predominantly the number one issue. Number two, degrading a regime that is the bully of the Middle East, that has harassed its neighbors and tried to destroy Israel. Well, what does that mean? It means do the best you can to degrade a government that is sprawling, that has existed for 47 years, and try to take them down without putting troops on the ground. So to me, one of the mistakes that President Bush made was saying it was weapons of mass destruction. When we know Saddam Hussein, there was a lot of reasons beyond weapons of mass destruction about why we needed to go in there, why there was an urgency for that. But people were focused on when the critics came happen and when the insurgency started taking root, people said, where are the weapons of mass destruction? This was a false war. And the president says, I'm not going to be put into a corner on one reason. I'll give you five. And they go, well, there's a lack of focus. Not really. It's to show you how needed this operation was.
Yeah. I think we heard the president talk about hoping that the people of Iran rise up and change their own regime. And I think that the strategy here is to soften everything around it to allow that to happen. They've taken out so many of these leaders. We don't know where this new Ayatollah is at the moment. We heard he was injured. The only images that you're seeing of him in Iran are a mural painted on the side of a wall. We haven't seen this guy. We don't know what kind of shape he's in. I think that it's interesting to, I always look at sort of what the president says at the tail end of his comments, because I think it can often be really telling. And he says, we don't want to have to go back and do this again in 5 years. That tells you what you need to know. They want to destroy the roots of this regime. Is that a very tall order? Yes. This regime is so divided into different silos that these silos don't trust each other. Every couple of years, huge factions of the leadership, the Ayatollah's leadership, would end up in prison because they were afraid that they were going to try to overthrow the leadership in Iran. So it's enormously complicated, but I think the president has a big picture goal here that's very significant.
And I think that it's very interesting that Netanyahu came forward and said to the Iranian people, the coming days will bring you opportunity to free yourselves. Now, look, president does talk loose with words. The prime minister doesn't. This is an intentional statement. Isn't a fourth question, walk into the plane. What do you think about the Iranian people? Yes, rise up. Now, this is, hey, I have a tape. Make sure this is rolling. I have a message. The coming days will bring an opportunity to free yourselves. Be ready as an elite counterterrorism unit has been deployed to protect Iran's newly appointed supreme leader. So he wants them to come out. Now, what he also has to do is find a way for them to get this. They have to find a way to get the internet back on, some type of Starlink system. Now, maybe with a lot of the besieged and the IRGC running for their lives, maybe people can be a little bolder and get some Starlink systems onto their apartment buildings. Because if they're caught with it, it's a death sentence.
Exactly. So obviously you have Elon Musk, who in the past has been, you know, very, tried to be very helpful in terms of restoring
this
internet
service. Look what he's doing in the Russia war.
Absolutely. He's been an incredible help in terms of Ukraine and communications there. This is a very tricky situation because they know if people can communicate, they are going to get this message and they are going to come out. The Israelis have had an extraordinary on-the-ground presence, intelligence presence, that has infiltrated this leadership. And that's how we knew, combined, obviously, with our CEA and John Ratcliffe, who were able to find out so much. So I think that the message will ultimately penetrate. But I think people have to be very careful about not being frustrated with the pace of the rising up of the Iranian people. They just had 30,000 of their own slaughtered in the streets. And we're now in the military phase of this campaign. And I think, you know, it's interesting. One other thing that President Trump said yesterday was that he wanted the targets to avoid the energy sector in Iran. So that says to me...
He told Israel.
Absolutely. So that says to me that he is starting to think to the next step right beyond these military targets. He's starting to think about preserving the energy because he would love to have some sort of deal. There's an enormous amount of resources in Iran with a new leadership. And I think that, you know, the significant comment by Netanyahu speaks loudly as well.
Because he does have a ground presence.
He
Mossad
does.
Is there. Says, we fully respect your sovereignty, culture, and heritage. You asked for help, and help has arrived. We'll continue to hit the growing force, going to hit with growing force the tyrants who terrorized you for decades. The Ayatollahs and their henchmen are on the run, but those cowards have nowhere to hide. In the coming days, we will create the conditions for you to grasp your destiny. Your dreams will become a reality. When the time is right and the time is fast approaching, we will pass the torch to you. Be ready to seize the moment.
It's an enormous message. And, you know, another stage that you can imagine in this is the opening of the doors at Evin prison, because there are a lot of people there who are reformers and who were part of the resistance, who are in that prison, who would like to be part of the overthrowing of this government. So these are enormous, enormous, consequential, very, very dangerous issues at hand. But I think Netanyahu's comments are very important.
So today we understand the Saudi Arabia oil fields got hit, the refinery. We know a couple of days ago Qatar's refinery got hit,
Oman.
The UAE and Oman. So they're trying to get to the energy sector. And I heard someone from one Trump official, I was surprised that they have not tried to get in the fight themselves. Oman and Qatar don't have much of a fighting force, but the others do, you know? So I just thought, even if it's symbolism, Saudi Arabia has been quite quiet about this. So I'm wondering, I hear the Trump people say, we don't really need them in the fight. But I think for their population, it would look good, I believe, if they were in the fight, sticking up for themselves.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they had a little bit of a heads up that Iran was planning to hit these countries, that they were not going to leave them out of the fight. And I think that was something that, you know, during the diplomacy back and forth before the war started, there were messages coming from Saudi Arabia that were kind of like, you know, we're a little concerned about this because we know they're going to come hit us because we all have U.S. bases where we are, and we all have obviously energy resources that they're going to try to hit as well, because this is such an enormous lashing out. It's like a death throw effort on the part of Iran right now. It is not what we saw in June. Remember, in June, it was like, where's the retaliation? When are they going to do something? They eventually did sort of a very minor retaliation at Al Udeid Air Base after we had already evacuated most people. There were some injuries as a result of that attack, but it was very, very limited. So this is a complete death throw, you know, sort of King Kong lashing out, trying to grab everything that's in the air.
Before he drowns.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's how I see it. And that's how a lot of people that I've spoken to see it. So I think, you know, it's a stay the course moment. I don't know why you're not seeing, I'm not sure how strong the capability of the military really is in some of the Gulf countries, because we haven't ever really seen it fully exercised. I know that they did, flyovers, you know, 6 months ago without any bombs on the planes because a lot of their pilots, you know, weren't really able to do that. But now we have seen them take down some Iranian jets. So I think they are getting up on their feet. And I think the fact that they're backing the effort and standing strongly with the United States and Israel, it does mean a lot.
Well, last Saturday, you saw the story right as it started that Saudi Arabia was pushing President Trump to act. Mm-hmm. So wait a second. The Gulf states are upset. They don't want to use our bases. Now, at the very least, they better, I assume they have allowed us to use their bases. In the beginning, they said you can't be based out of here. I assume that changed. Maybe they don't want to tell their population. I'm not sure. Or the Iranians.
Yeah, I mean, but it's such a sea change from what we saw. I mean, think about what we heard from the allies, from our typical historical allies on this, from the UK, from France, and their like day late, dollar short reaction, I think, just tells you what you need to know about the changing dynamic in the world. You've got Gulf states lining up with Israel, okay? Mm-hmm. And you have European nations not coming to our aid until they're pressed. Think about the fact that these countries in Europe sent, albeit very small forces to Greenland because they were so upset like that 10. Greenland yeah. was going to be invaded by President Trump. They reacted like that to that idea. Well, we got to go protect Greenland from President Trump. But then when they're asked to be part of this historic effort to take down this country that everyone has been trying to isolate for decades, they're like, I don't know, don't touch our base though. Yeah. Maybe we'll help you in a defensive posture. Oh, it's not in our constitution to do that. And then they all start coming around. It just makes them look extraordinarily
weak. Well, Prime Minister Starmer said, well, this is a legal war. I got to find a legal Come justification on. For it. You know what they found? They had two of their battleships were heading up to the Arctic. Mm-hmm. So they're going to head up to the Arctic to guard Greenland yeah. against a U.S. invasion, and they had to bring them back home.
I don't know. There's like a Monty Python-esque element to that whole move, I got to say.
Right. It's interesting. But, you know, to their defense a little bit, Trump never really asked them. You know, he did this on his own. Mm-hmm. He didn't say, NATO, I got to have a meeting. Do you have a Zoom?
Don't you think he was concerned it would leak?
True.
I mean, I think that the integrity of the mission was the highest priority.
You see what Tony Blair said?
Mm-mm.
Tony Blair said, you absolutely be standing
Oh, yes,
the
I did.
Yeah.
Right yeah, away. Absolutely.
And he so-called liberal or.
Right. Well, you know, that's the older age of liberalism. It's much closer to the middle than yeah. the current stage that we're dealing with. It's a totally different, you know, even Clinton sort of version of liberalism. It barely exists anymore.
Martha, be right back. You're going to tease what's going to be on your show?
Sure.
All right.
Look forward to it.
You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Martha McCallum's here a few more minutes. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Hey, we're back. Martha McCallum's here. Her show's at 3 o'clock today. And Martha, have you thought about your show?
Yes, we have. We've been thinking about it all day. And just two things I want to quickly point out. We have Senator Dave McCormick on the SAVE Act, which I know is very important to the president, very important to a lot of our viewers. So we're going to drill down on that and see where Senator McCormick stands on that. We also have a woman who played football in Iran, and we're going to talk about what's going on with these soccer players. Yes, she played an indoor version of professional Iranian team. She defected in 2017 to Switzerland and became a coach, but all she ever wanted was to represent Iran or represent her team. Mm. But she said, if I can't do it, you know, without covering my hair or not wearing shorts, you know, I don't understand why my country just won't let me do that even in other countries, because she was posting pictures like that. So we have this incredible video of the IRGC guys reportedly chasing the soccer players down the stairs, Iranian soccer players, and then trying to get through a door that was locked as six of them escaped their country and are now living in Australia. It's an incredibly emotional, heartbreaking story. They've left their families in Iran and they worry about their safety in Iran. Other players, one of them broke down and ended up getting back on the bus. It's just a really emotional story that I think says so much about this regime. And I think it opens the human heart story of what it's like to love your country of Iran and yet be subjected to so many horrific tortures and right. punishments.
So where is Jane Fonda, Megan Rapinoe?
Exactly.
About
no,
women's
we invited
rights?
Rapinoe on the show the last 2 days. She's not interested in talking about this issue. Why wouldn't this be right up her alley?
Soccer,
freedom for these women?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Ability to express themselves, some showing courage, some having to go back or they'll kill their families.
No, it's crazy how the lines have changed in terms of normal, like human rights issues that, you know, people who used to be very dependable on these sorts of things. You point out Jane Fonda, like, yeah, where are you? They see it as, they're afraid that they will be seen as like as anti-Muslim, I guess, if they're supporting these women,
many of
whom are Muslims, on this soccer team.
Or they know that Trump's for asylum, and they think that got to be the opposite.
Anything. Anything that, you know, would shed light on him, I guess, is just a no-go, which is so, it's immature and ridiculous way of communicating.
So the main thing is, they had the rest of the team got on that flight to go home crying.
Yeah.
The five or six ended up staying. They had seven. The other one went back.
Now.
But they say, listen, you want your family to be tortured? That's going to happen if you don't get on that plane. It's not a matter of you. You can live in Australia.
Think about
this. But the president pushed them to do this.
I know. And the families, in some cases, they were able to get in touch with the families, these interlocutors. And some of the families told these girls, stay in Australia. We'll be okay. Do not come back. Can you imagine if one of your children, you know, was in that position and you're telling them, don't ever come home again. We want you to stay outside of the country, even if it means that the rest of us back here are going to go to prison. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean,
this is what's at stake. This is what people are glossing over. And you talk about those headlines in the New York Times. You know, this, to me, this story says almost everything you need to know about what these women are living through in Iran.
Yeah, and in Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
For 20 years, they said, well, we waste our time. Well, for 20 years, these people had a chance to have an education, hold positions of power, and get out of the back rooms of their house and be able to walk around with others and give a great, be a great example to women for a generation. And that's why the more we stayed, the more we had a chance to maybe them get some traction. But in the end, I think we ruined our reputation there. And I think we're beginning to get it back, especially with the friendships that have been galvanized with these Gulf states. Now, if we run out of interceptors and they start having the desalinization plants blow up and they lose some of their oil fields, things could change about that. But my sense is we're going to pick up the pace. They can't regenerate their ballistic missile program. They don't have a nuclear program right now. We're destroying that too. So my sense is things are going to get better and there's going to be a couple of bad days. But this is what happens when you corner a devilish regime.
Yeah, but there has to be some avenue to protect people to come out of their houses to rise up against this regime. And I think that is the next stage in all of this, which is going to be a very, very delicate part of this story.
I know, but cool. Let's keep covering it. 3 o'clock today, Martha, you're going to be covering that. We're expanding a little bit. We're in day 12. I sense we're going to be going for at least another couple of weeks with this, because the big fear that these Arab states have is that we'll end it early. Mm-hmm. Leave them wounded. Don't leave them dead.
Yeah. Well, the president says he doesn't want to come back to this conflict a couple years down the road.
Either do we, because it means a lot of long hours, and we only have one turn.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Martha.
Thank you, Brian. Always good to be with you.
Thank you.